You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. In the aftermath of the terrorist attacks 2 years ago, and as the war on Afghanistan was winding down, one young American gained worldwide notoriety as the public face of September 11th. 20-year-old John Walker Lynn was called everything from the American Taliban to the most reviled American traitor since Lee Harvey Oswald. But now, author and Middle East journalist Mark Kukas has written a new book that goes far beyond the name-calling to give readers a sense of who Lynn was and what his motivations might have been. Kukas stopped by our studios recently and spoke with Peace Watch producer Scott Gurian about his book entitled My Heart Became Attached, The Strange Odyssey of John Walker Lynn.
When Lynn was first discovered in Afghanistan, outside of Mazar-e Sharif in December of 2001, I was in another corner of Afghanistan working as a freelance contributor for Salon.com, covering the fighting at Tora Bora. So I had heard rumors that there had been American found in the northern parts of Afghanistan. I was curious, like most others. But getting news in Afghanistan, especially during that time, was a little difficult. Eventually, I made my way back to Islamabad, where there's a little bit more of a connection to the rest of the world, and I began to read some newspapers and magazines, and like millions of others, was really just sort of compelled by all the improbable drama of his story. And as the conflict sort of wound down in December, I was still looking for more writing projects, and my agent suggested that I focus on Lynn as a biography figure who could potentially bring together a lot of the stories surrounding September 11th and the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan. We realized pretty quickly early on that I wasn't going to get a chance to interview him. At the time he was first brought into U.S. military custody, people were talking about putting him to death, and he was being held incommunicado indefinitely. So I began retracing his steps through Pakistan, Afghanistan, Yemen, and back to California as other reporters began to look into this story, and also court papers began to emerge surrounding his case that offered a rough sketch of where his footsteps had gone through these regions.
Take us a little bit into John Walker Lynn's personal history. I want you to answer the question posed in your book, what would cause an intelligent, well-educated, and by all accounts, privileged Californian to forego an easy life in the United States, a struggle for survival in a land of strife and mortal danger? How did John Walker Lynn come to arrive in Yemen and eventually join up with the Taliban?
It's sort of a confluence of events over the course of about 3 years that led him, and there's no single moment or one radical turn on his part that led him to that point. He went to Afghanistan initially as a 17-year-old with basically a high school education and what most Europeans know as a gap year. He was taking some study abroad Arabic courses. It was kind of weird. You know, I don't know too many parents who would let their kids study at 17 and 18 in the tribal areas of Pakistan, largely alone. But, I mean, whatever. I've heard of weirder things among teenagers. And the fact that, you know, he was exceedingly bright, you know, he has a really high IQ, always excelled in school, and was never sort of like a behavioral problem as a kid. Mm-hmm. You know, that, to me, suggests that he, you know, had a level of maturity, at least in his parents' eyes, that he could be trusted to go and have these experiences as an educational thing, rather than any sort of wandering journey into other worlds. He had already converted to Islam at that point as an adolescent, and you know, quickly gravitated in his religious experience toward a literal interpretation, as a lot of converts towards any religion oftentimes do.
What, was it a personal decision to convert to Islam? Was that a family thing? What was that that motivated him?
It was very much an individual exploration religiously on his part. He had looked into a number of religions, Buddhism and Christianity and Judaism, and gravitated towards Islam, and basically on his own came to an understanding through readings that he shaped himself. He did some heavy religious study before he ever showed up at the Marin County Mosque, where he actually converted to Islam, which in Marin County, just outside of San Francisco. So in Yemen, he's studying Arabic, and he begins to meet people who have fought in Afghanistan in the 1980s. When the United States was involved in supporting the Mujahideen against the Soviets, they created this culture of radicalized militants who, after the conflict was over, drifted back to where they'd come from, largely across the Middle East, and these guys became sort of a Mujahideen underground, a loose network of men who had fought in Afghanistan and were interested in fighting in other places because they had adopted this ideological framework and did a lot of hanging around in religious universities, mosques, and madrasas. Lynn first got ideas about jihad and holy war in Yemen from such people, and he became convinced there that he had to, as a Muslim, undertake some sort of military mission to help other Muslims, just as sure as you had to pray five times a day or fast during Ramadan or, you know, travel once to Mecca in a lifetime. He became convinced that that was just part of his religious duty. And then it just became a question of when and where.
And so how did he arrive in Afghanistan then?
Well, from Yemen, he ran into visa problems. He would have stayed in Yemen longer, but he was just having difficulties coming up with a student visa. On a sojourn back to San Francisco during between study stints in Yemen, he met a Pakistani by the name of Hizr Hayat, who was with a Islamic missionary group that was traveling through the West Coast. He explained his situation in Yemen to this Pakistani guy, Hizr Hayat, and Hizr Hayat said, "Well, if you're having problems with schools, come to Pakistan. I'll show you the madrasa scenes, the unofficial religious schools that sort of flower all across Pakistan in the absence of a proper educational system." So Lind took his contact information, and they stayed in touch a little bit. And then when it became time that he had to leave Yemen, he contacted Hizr Hayat and said, "I'm still interested in studying abroad. I'm not ready to go back to the States. Are you serious about showing me around the madrasas?" And Hizr Hayat said, "Yes, of course." So he bought a ticket, arrived in Pakistan in early part of 2001, and then began studying at a madrasa that Hizr Hayat showed him to. Afghanistan didn't really enter the picture for him until sort of late in his experience traveling. In Banu, the small town in Pakistan, while he was studying the Quran and Arabic more, he still had this idea that he had to fight some sort of holy war on behalf of Muslims. And in Pakistan, the conflict in Kashmir really pervades the press and is sort of a real galvanizing war cry for society there. And so he began to absorb this literature about the Kashmir conflict and became convinced that Kashmir was the fight for him. He was close enough to go. There was nothing to stop him, and it was his sort of obligatory religious duty. So he joins Kashmiri militants, undergoes basically a month of militant training in the foothills of Kashmir, and at some point he becomes disenchanted. He thought the Kashmir insurgency was a grassroots effort. It turns out it's more a geopolitical engineering on behalf of the Pakistani military to sort of bleed India in this region. So and his Kashmir trainers, who I met in Pakistan, they didn't think he was such a great soldier either. They didn't think they could use him. Frankly, it's pretty rough terrain to go wage a guerrilla insurgency in Kashmir, so they sort of a mutual parting of ways at that point. He still had the idea that he wanted to fight. The next closest place was Afghanistan. So they basically wrote him a letter of recommendation and sent him to Kabul. He arrives in Kabul. Quickly they size him up and say, "You don't have enough military training. We need you, if you want to fight with the Taliban, you need at least several more weeks." He didn't speak Pashto, Urdu, or Dari. He only spoke Arabic. So the only place you can get Arabic training in Afghanistan was in Osama bin Laden's camps. So he went to Al-Qaeda camp outside of Kandahar.
And so wasn't this sort of unusual for someone who's an outsider, particularly an American, to come and join the local resistance movement there in Afghanistan?
I mean, everybody I talked to who knew Lin, remarked on the fact that he was unusual. But he wasn't a complete anomaly. Through the court, the best FBI estimates of Americans, for example, who had traveled through Pakistan and Afghanistan and part of the sort of underground jihadi railroad through the course of the 1990s is, hundreds, perhaps 600 or so. A terrible, influx of Americans, but nonetheless, not completely unheard of to have someone like Lin's profile there, at least in terms of appearance, if not background. And there were a number of other Caucasians that were running around in Afghanistan as well. When Lin was first found, he was among, a number of people who were apparently from Chechnya who have, fair complexions. Mm-hmm. And, there was also an Australian among them, a guy named David Hicks. So it was unusual but not unheard of. Mm-hmm. So for him to be, an American or a Westerner in these camps that was largely, training people from Saudi Arabia and other Gulf states.
What exactly was the extent of his involvement with the Taliban?
Basically, he was a frontline volunteer. And bin Laden, in addition to his terrorist aims, worldwide, he also, with these camps in Afghanistan, helped create sort of a grunt force that he offered to the Taliban in exchange for them harboring him. So Lin was part of this group. Bin Laden would take young volunteers from largely from the Middle East, run them through several weeks of guerrilla training, and then have the Afghan Taliban ship them off to the frontline areas where they would serve as sort of like shock troops. And Lin was part of that. In these camps, there were also a number of individuals who were sort of plucked for further terrorist training and who went on to do things of darker ambitions in other parts of the world. Lin was offered such a role. Late in his training, one of the trainers approached him and said, "Are you interested in taking on a mission in the United States or Israel?" And Lin said, "No, I'm committed to the idea of helping the Taliban shore up Afghanistan against the Northern Alliance. That's what I want to do." While he had been in Pakistan, in addition to absorbing sympathies for the Kashmiri cause, he began to delve more into religious conservatism and identify more with the Taliban's brand of Islamic ideology as well. So the two sort of combined. He had this sense that he needed to fight. His religious views were more and more shaped by the conservatism he experienced in these tribal areas along the Afghan border, and there was an ongoing conflict and a clear sort of circuit or network, if you will, that he could just sort of plug right into, even as a foreigner, and wind up serving on the front lines with the Taliban and other foreign volunteers when September 11th struck.
Remind us of the details of when and where he was captured by American forces.
Shortly after September 11th, Lind and his unit fell into retreat with the advance of U.S. forces in northern Afghanistan. The rally point for this retreat in northern Afghanistan became a town called Kunduz, and the biggest town just outside of that is Mazar-e-Sharif. The Taliban basically surrendered at Kunduz, a large group of them did, and part of the surrender deal called for all the foreigners to be handed over to the Northern Alliance warlord Rashid Dostum. And so Lind was part of a group of 400 foreigners who were given by the Afghan Taliban to the Northern Alliance as prisoners. These men were trucked from this town called Kunduz to Mazar-e-Sharif and put in a prison fortress for overnight keeping, roughly 400 of them or so. And they spent one night in a basement, and then when dawn broke the next day, and this is basically, late November, last days of November, all these prisoners are brought up, seated on the yard, and they're interrogated by Afghans and by two CIA agents, Michael Spann and a guy named Dave Tyson. And these are the images that we sort of most of us know of Lin, this of him sort of, dirty and skinny and very hairy and hunched, in the dirt as Spann's questioning him. That exchange took place moments before a violent battle erupted. Basically, the prisoners had managed to hide quite a good deal of arms under their clothes, grenades, pistols, knives, and staged an uprising. And the battle spun out of control and lasted for about a week. And when it was over, of the 400 men who were initially imprisoned, there was only about 86 left. Lin was among them. He was found by a CNN freelance correspondent, a guy named Robert Young Pelton. And these 86 men were brought up out of this basement after a week of holding out, laid out in this hospital on one cold night in December. And most of them died that night. And as these Afghans were trying to save who they could among these prisoners, a doctor and a cameraman happened upon Lind, and Lind at that point said, "I'm an American," very weakly. And quickly, Pelton, who was on a freelance assignment doing a profile of Dostum, was alerted by Afghans, and then unfolded this interview that aired on CNN that we all saw. And it was only one of two times that Lind was able to speak out publicly, once in his initial discovery, which led to his military arrest, and then lastly at his sentencing hearing, where he accepted a guilty plea for joining the Taliban, and the sentence calls for 20 years, and he'll serve 17 with time off for good behavior.
What was his defense again?
The case became quite complicated, starting with John Ashcroft's heated rhetoric about who Lind was that I think sort of shaped a character, a persona of him that didn't quite measure up to who he was. According to Ashcroft, he was, a terrorist and a follower of Osama bin Laden. It doesn't quite fit with Lind. And not only does it not quite fit with Lind, but Ashcroft's rhetoric didn't match the government's case against him. Lind wasn't charged with anything related to treason, terrorism, or murder. There was really no history of any sort of prosecution like his in the U.S. courts. Basically, Lin was charged with violating sanctions against Afghanistan, and it was sort of a weak charge.
After all that we heard about him being a traitor and treasonous and so forth, that was sort of the worst that he was charged with?
Yeah. But that wasn't to say that he was going to get off light. I mean, the government wasn't going to let him go. And after it became clear that the case was complicated and weaker than what had been billed by the government, the government started looking for a plea agreement. And the defense wanted a plea agreement, too, because the idea that Lind would, you know, get out of a trial held 9 miles from the Pentagon, opening roughly on the year anniversary of September 11th, was just... It was almost unimaginable that he could get away with anything less than 40 years, perhaps life in prison. So the defense wanted some sort of plea agreement. The prosecution wanted some sort of plea agreement because they didn't want to go forward with this trial because their legal arguments were very tenuous as well. So they quickly came to a pretty intelligent settlement. You know, Lind basically agreed to serve 20 years and agreed to joining the Taliban, which is something he never denied. He was strenuous in his denials that he did anything related to terrorism. He insists that he never supported terrorism and has no sympathies towards bin Laden and al-Qaeda. And that's, to me, in my opinion, believable. There's a number of murky areas, even for me, because I didn't have a chance to interview him and because some of the things don't quite add up. If he didn't support bin Laden and al-Qaeda to some degree, then his association with bin Laden and his trainers outside of Kandahar is hard to reconcile with that. It seems at some point he must have understood the relationship between the Taliban and al-Qaeda. And if he did, then he at least complicitly supported those aims.
Was he aware of the events of September 11th while he was over there? And what were his thoughts on that incident?
I traveled to the sort of front line stretch where he was when September 11th unfolded. And he was with a group of about 50 other volunteers serving on the front lines. It's really remote. There's nothing out there. There's certainly no phones, TV, radio, anything like that. They heard about September 11th word of mouth. And I think it's easy to take for granted that we all saw those images instantly and knew, you know, within moments the scale of the carnage. But it's something quite different to hear, you know, there's been an attack in New York and hear silence in this lonely stretch of Afghanistan. So only bit by bit over the course of weeks did he begin to get a picture, word of mouth, as his unit moved around in a confusing situation in Afghanistan. He came to a full realization and sort of finally, once he was brought back to the United States and his attorneys brought in a laptop computer to his jail cell and showed him pictures of the planes crashing into the buildings and the collapse. And so at that point, I think only did he fully grasp what had happened and why there was so much grief and rage surrounding his particular story.
And what was his point of view at that point?
According to his attorneys, at that point, he became sort of resigned to the idea that he was going to pay a heavy price because of the political climate in the wake of September 11th and because of his unusual circumstances. He apparently approached it without any sort of sense of resentment and, you know, just kind of came to a almost bliss-like understanding that this was his fate, you know, by happenstance, part by happenstance, part by choices of his own. And he apparently, you know, has remained in good spirits and served out his time.
Aside from his feelings about his own fate, about the attacks itself, did he, from the accounts that you've heard, feel any sympathy for the attackers or anything like that?
He addressed this question in his court statement. He gave at a sentencing hearing, he spoke at length about a number of questions surrounding his case, and one of which is he denounced the attacks on September 11th, said he saw no role for you know, Osama bin Laden's ideology in either his religion or on a political stage. So he sort of vociferously distanced himself from that.
And he I believe I read this as well, he said that there was no nothing, no teaching in Islam that would lead to, you know, engaging in such attacks.
That's his belief, yeah. That suicide missions are contradictory to
the teachings of Islam.
Right.
It seems as though the writing of, you know, this book, My Heart Became Attached, The Strange Odyssey of John Walker Lind, seems somewhat almost unusual and even courageous, because in the post-September 11th world, it seems as though it's taboo to have any sort of intelligent discussion or attempt to answer questions like, why do they hate us? You know, the infamous question we hear everywhere. And to attempt to sort of get into the mind of the enemy. We saw, you know, talk show host Bill Maher, who was fired from his program Politically Incorrect for his comments that the terrorists who attacked, you know, flew the planes into the World Trade Center and the Pentagon were in some ways more courageous than the Air Force, American Air Force and British Air Force pilots who dropped bombs from 20, 30, 40,000 feet. You know, we also saw the musician Steve Earle, who wrote this song about John Walker Lind, received tons of hate mail and was almost, I guess, sort of blacklisted for doing that and attempting to get into the mind of the so-called enemy. What was it like writing this book? I mean, obviously, it didn't mean that you necessarily supported Lind or the Taliban or anything, but was that the perception that there was? How has this been received?
I expected some sort of backlash at some point, and I haven't really felt any. And I think there's two reasons for that. I think that the initial climate surrounding September 11th has eased quite
time
a bit.
Time has passed.
Yeah, time has passed, and things are just a lot less raw. And secondly, I think, you know, Lind himself has done a lot to dispel much of the hatred that surrounds him. The day he was sentenced, there was an interesting contrast because also Richard Reed, the alleged shoe bomber, also went to jail that day. And in his sentencing hearing, he went sort of cackling away and vowing war against the United States. Lind, in that same afternoon, sobbed in court, expressed remorse for joining the Taliban, denounced bin Laden and al-Qaeda, and went away, you know, to an almost a very sort of touching scene with his family, you know, expressing support behind him. So I think those things have combined to undercut any sort of sense of backlash that I might have gotten. And also, people are just really curious about him, I think. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I'm struck again and again by how when I go out to book signings or do interviews about how oftentimes there's enough people around, I can hardly get in a word because people have thoughts. You know, they remember this story. They have a lot of questions, and it animates people in a curious way. And I think that also helps to open up people's minds.
Mm-hmm. What insights have you gained from writing this book, and what lessons have you learned, and do you think other people can learn from hearing John Walker Lind's story?
I think, to me, the most important lesson I took from this was that U.S. actions on the world stage, especially displays of force and violence, have, you know, a ripple effect that lasts decades. And it's not too much of a stretch in logic to say that Lind is a product of the U.S. support of the Mujahideen in Afghanistan in the 1980s against the Soviets. And that was a turn in history that we're still feeling the repercussions of. Bin Laden is also a product of that era. And that was, I think, a situation where the United States acted irresponsibly on the world stage, and we're feeling the effects of that, you know, year after year after year after year. And in terms of events unfolding today, I think it's important to keep in mind that you have to really conduct yourselves as a nation with a high degree of moral conscience and with a view that, you know, the actions that you take today, especially actions of force, you know, are going to have a lasting effect, not just next year or the year after, but decade upon decade upon decade.
Mark Kukas is a former White House correspondent for United Press International, and he covered the war in Afghanistan as a freelance writer and journalist. He spoke with Peace Watch producer Scott Gurian about his new book entitled My Heart Became Attached, The Strange Odyssey of John Walker Lind.
I'm just an American boy raised on MTV and a scene on a kids in the soda pop bands, but none of them look like me. So I started looking around for a light out of the dim, and the first thing I heard that made sense was the word of Muhammad, peace be upon him. I shined the la 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 la. There's no God but God if my daddy could see me now. Chains around my feet. He don't understand that sometimes a man's got to fight for what he believes.
John Walker's Blues by musician Steve Earle.
Thank you.
Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. Our producer is Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is T from the Pattersons taking the train to Tibet. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening.